We're holding Parshas Ve'era, and we'll try to do a quick overview before we go through the Parsha in depth. If you recall, last week's Parsha ended with Moshe asking God, why'd you do this? You sent me, and ever since I came to Pharaoh, things only got worse. And God told him, now you'll see what I will do. Ultimately, Pharaoh will send him out with a strong hand. And now God tells Moshe, I appear to the forefathers with the name Kel Shakai, and I never revealed them my name Hashem. And I gave them a promise to give them, I made a treaty with them to give them the land that they lived there. And I've heard the cry of the Jewish people that the Egyptians are working them, and I remember my treaty. Therefore, tell the Jewish people, I am Hashem, and I will take them out from under the sufferings of Mitzrayim. We are going to have four terms of redemption for the process of leaving Egypt. I'll take you out. I will save you from the servitude. I will redeem you with an outstretched hand. I'll take you from my nation. You will know that I am the God who took you out of the suffering of Egypt, and I will bring you to the land of Israel. Moshe tells the Jewish people, and they don't have strength to listen. They're working too hard. God tells Moshe, come tell Pharaoh that he should send the Jews out. And Moshe says, the Jews won't listen to me. Pharaoh's going to listen to me? I can't even speak clearly. And God tells Moshe and Aaron to go and start the process of taking the Jews out of Egypt. And now we go into a little bit of history. The Torah records the lineage of Moshe and Aaron, where they come from, and who Aaron's wife was, etc. And we get fill in on the lineage of the whole tribe of Levi. Why? Oh, good question. God tells Moshe, I'm running the show, you go tell Pharaoh whatever I tell you. And Moshe repeats his claim. Says, I can't speak, well, how will Pharaoh listen? And God tells him, you're in charge, Aaron will be your speaker, and what I tell you, you speak. And I'm forewarning you that I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and there will be many miracles in Egypt. Pharaoh won't listen to you, and I will punish the Egyptians. And I will take out my armies, my nation, the Jewish people. The Jewish people are more than one army. Why are they called my armies, plural? I'll take them out with great signs, with great judgments. And the Egyptians will know that I am God. Why is it so important that the Egyptians know that God is the one running the show? And I'll take out the Jewish people from within their midst. And Moshe and Aaron do what God tells them. Moshe is 80, Aaron is 83. Aaron is the big brother when they stand to speak before Pharaoh. Hashem tells Moshe and Aaron when Pharaoh asks for a sign. So Moshe, you tell Aaron to throw his staff to the floor and it'll turn into a snake. They come before Pharaoh, they do what God tells them. Aaron throws the staff to the floor and Pharaoh calls his wife and she says, I could do that too. He calls the little kids. They say, we could do that too. They all throw their sticks to the ground and they turn into snakes. And Aaron's staff swallows up their staff. Pharaoh isn't interested in listening. And God tells Moshe, I see his heart is heavy. Go in the morning. He's going out to the water. And you stand before him when he's going out to the Nile. Take that special staff that turned into a snake with you. And tell him, God, the God of the Hebrews sent me to you, telling you, send my nation, and you haven't listened so far. So says God, with this you will know, I will hit with my staff the water of the Nile, it will turn to blood, the fish will die, the Nile will smell, the Egyptians won't be able to drink water from the Nile. We know the Nile is the source of sustenance. First attack, the source of sustenance. And that's what happens. Moshe raises his hand, everything turns to blood. The Egyptians do the same. Pharaoh hardens his heart. He's not willing to listen. He goes back home. The Egyptians have to dig in order to get some water to drink. And after 7 days, everything turns back to normal. God tells Moshe, tell Pharaoh, send my nation. You're not willing to listen. I'll send Sparzi'im, which for now we'll translate as frogs. So frogs will plague your nation. They'll come in from the Nile and they'll fill your homes and everything. And they forewarn him. And that's what happens. Frogs come hopping out and they fill Egypt. The Egyptian magicians show that they could do the same. Pharaoh calls Moshe and Aaron. He says, please pray that the frogs will leave and I'll send the nation and they'll serve their God. We see by the second plague, Pharaoh's already breaking down. Moshe tells Pharaoh, okay, make it hard for me. When should I pray? And Pharaoh says, tomorrow. And he says, fine, as you wish. You'll see that there's none like Hashem our God. The frogs will leave and they'll only remain in the Nile. They leave. Moshe calls out to Hashem. He has to yell. There are a lot of frogs around. God can't hear if he doesn't yell. God does as Moshe asks, and the frogs die. And now the Egyptians have piles of dead frogs around the country. Pharaoh sees things are better. He's not listening. God tells Moshe, without forewarning, bring on the plague of Kinim. Lice. Aaron extends his staff. He hits the earth. And there's lice throughout the land. The Egyptian magicians try and they can't duplicate that. They tell Pharaoh that's the finger of God, and Pharaoh is stubborn and he's not listening. God tells Moshe, wake up early, go before Pharaoh, tell him that he should send the nation. If he doesn't, I'm going to send against him wild animals and they'll fill the Egyptian territory, and then I will show that the land of Goshen is my men, the Jewish people. There will not attack wild animals in the land of Goshen. I will also show that Jews are different. If a Jew is in Egyptian territory, he won't be harmed. And that's what happens. Wild animals start entering from the desert and they start killing people throughout Egypt. Pharaoh calls Moshe and Aaron and says, get out of here, you guys go serve your gods throughout the land. And Moshe says, we can't do that, we're going to sacrifice the Egyptian idols. We can't do that, they'll be very upset if we just have to go 3 days journey into the desert. Pharaoh says, fine, I'll send you off, just pray for me, don't go too far away. Moshe says, I'm going to walk out and pray to God, and tomorrow all the wild animals will leave. Moshe goes out. Why do the animals have to leave? Because the Egyptians shouldn't enjoy from the fur and the hide that they could get from the wild animals. Yeah?
Why do we need Moshe to say, first you let me go, and then we'll let the
animals out? Good question. It seems like this game is supposed to go on. For what reason? Oh, so we'll get to that. Pharaoh hardens his heart. He doesn't send the nation. God tells Moshe, forewarn Pharaoh, again, send the Hebrews. If you don't, then God will harm your cattle. All your cattle will have a huge plague, and they're going to drop dead. And then again, you'll see the difference between Jew, Israeli, and Egyptian. And tomorrow, that's what's going to be. And that's what happens. They have a day to think about it, and the next day, they haven't repented. So all of the Egyptian cattle drop dead. And in the Jewish cattle, not even one drops dead. Pharaoh says, I got to check this out. He sends his men. They check out through the Israeli camp. No cattle drop dead that day. Pharaoh hardens his heart. He's not sending the nation. He's in a bad state. All their cattle's dead. God tells Moshe, now take each of you, Moshe and Aaron, a fistful of coal, of ash, earth. And Moshe, you take all four fistfuls, put it in one hand and throw it in the air, and it'll scatter throughout Egypt and land on the people and turn into boils. That's what happens. They stand before Pharaoh, and in front of Pharaoh, Moshe throws it into the heavens, and everyone starts having boils. The men, whatever animals were left. And the magicians couldn't even stand there. They were so embarrassed they were covered with all these different blisters and boils. And Pharaoh's heart was hardened. He wasn't listening. God hardened Pharaoh's heart now. Now God is hardening his heart. God tells Moshe, go up early, stand before Pharaoh and tell him, send, God said, send the Hebrews. This time I'm going to send a tremendous plague to your heart. If I wanted to, I'd drop you and make you all drop dead now, but I don't want to. I want to show my strength that my name will become famous throughout the land. Starting to hear an answer. If you keep playing games with my nation, so tomorrow there will be a heavy hail that Egypt never encountered anything like it from the day it was established till now. And now go gather your cattle. Any animal and cattle that's in the field will die from the hail. Anyone who fears God's word brings everyone into the house. And whoever didn't care, so they left it in the field. They left their slaves and animals in the field. And God tells Moshe, extend your hand. The hail starts falling. Whoever's left in the field is dead. There are all kinds of noises as the hail comes tumbling down and fire comes tumbling down. And in the land of Goshen, everything's peaceful. Pharaoh sends, he calls Moshe and Aaron, says, this time I have sinned, Hashem is the tzaddik, mean my nation are sinful, please pray to God, we've had enough, I'll send you and you won't remain here. Moshe says, I'll leave the city, extend my hands, and the amazing noises and hail will cease because God owns the land. And you and your servants, I know you're not yet fearful of God. What's the point that they should be fearful of God? The young saplings, young barley that hadn't yet grown into strong stalks, bent under the weight of the hail but wasn't destroyed. But wheat and kusemet, the spelt, the barley did get destroyed because it was already hardened. The wheat and the spelt were still young and they bent under the weight, they didn't get destroyed. Moshe prays, the hail stops, Pharaoh sees that it stops, he continues sinning, he weighs down on his heart, he and his servants, and he doesn't send the Jews out, just as God has told Moshe, and our parsha ends in the middle of the story. What's going on here? What's the point? Like Josh asked, why not say, you want to let them go now, while the plague is going on. What did Moshe say to God? Moshe said, I know you're going to save the Jews. You promised you'll save them. But I also know that you sent me, and 3 days passed, and you didn't save them. And during these 3 days, everything got worse. And it got so bad, the Jews are cursing me out already. And why? If the time hadn't come to save the Jewish people, so why'd you send me? Why have these 3 days passed and things only got worse? And God answers him. There are different understandings as to what God told him when God answered him. We know that God wasn't pleased with Moshe's question. According to some opinions, this was the sin that he ultimately paid for with his life. In life, one of the greatest difficulties is seeing that there's bad in the world. Bad things happen to people. And we've had prophets, starting with Moshe over here, who had posed the question to God. In Treyasar, we also have, in the book Nahum, I think, Nahum or Habakkuk, I think it was Habakkuk, that he took a stick and he made a circle in the ground and he said, God, I see in a prophetic vision that the Jewish people are going to suffer at the hands of the Assyrian Empire, the Babylonian Empire. I see terrible things are going to happen to the Jewish people. I'm not stepping out of the circle till I have answers to questions I have. So we know a similar story from Choni HaMe'agel, but the original story happened in Treyasar. And he was punished for that. So Moshe Rabbeinu over here also questions what's going on. And God answers him. He says, you know, I feel bad, so to speak, that the forefathers aren't here. The forefathers only had promises. I told them things would be good for their children, and they never got to see any of the promises come to fruition. And they didn't come and question what was going on. They were all tested, and they didn't, and you did. You're not on their level. Woe on those that have been lost and can't find them. They don't make things like they used to. There's an understanding that what God was telling Moshe was the following. Let's say Moshe would walk onto the scene and say, time for the Jews to go. And the Egyptians would say, okay. Then God would say, well, the Egyptians have to be punished for all the suffering they put the Jews through. So up in heaven, the Egyptian angel would come forward and say, God, in the Torah it's written that you pre-decreed that the Jews would be in servitude for 400 years. How could you punish the Egyptians for doing what you decreed? You said it should happen. You brought them down to Egypt. So what did the Egyptians do wrong? They did what you decreed. So God teaches us that in order for us to make such a claim, we have to really be doing it because we're God's messengers. What God did was, God sent word to Pharaoh and said, Let the Jews go without bringing the hail, without bringing all these signs. And Pharaoh said, who's God? And not only am I not sending them out, but I'm going to make it worse. And he made their lives miserable. And he had 3 days during which he could have changed his mind, and the Egyptian people could have protested. Someone could have said this is wrong. No one did. Everyone partook of the torture of the Jewish people. What? We see. That's what the Torah testifies to in last week's parsha. That the Jews came wailing to Paro. They said, we can't handle this. We're not going to live through this. And they turned to Moshe and Aaron and they said, you gave them a sword with which to kill us. Because you came to them, now they made our lives even more miserable. So everyone here partook of these 3 days making the Jews' lives miserable. And after these 3 days are up, Moshe's had enough. Says, God, what's going on here? And God's saying, no. The purpose is that now the Egyptians can't claim we did this because God, you decreed. By refusing to accept God's word, God said, let them go. And now the Egyptians said, what? No way, who's God? We're going to make it worse. Now they're up in heaven, the Egyptian angel can't step forward and say, God, you decreed so. In heaven, God says, yeah, I decreed so. They were doing it because they cared for my word, and I just said, stop. They're not listening. Not only are they not listening, they're making it even worse. They're making it so inhuman. Until now it was inhuman, now it's even worse. So that we will get to in a minute. Shkwa. That's the next step. God uses 4 terms for the redemption of the Jewish people. Corresponding to those 4 terms, our sages instituted that we drink 4 glasses of wine at the Seder, the night when we commemorate leaving Egypt. What? Okay. So, what's the idea of 4 cups of wine? In Tanakh, cups of wine represent the sahar of the tzaddikim. As the verse states, Kos Yeshua Tessa, a cup of redemption, salvation, I uplift, Kosi Revaya, it represents the good that comes to tzaddikim, and it also represents the bad that comes to Rishon. When the Navi wants to describe a nation that's going to be punished, so the Navi describes the nation being given to drink at Kos HaTareila, so a cup of wine that has poison in it. And wine represents both extremes, both extreme good and extreme bad, and wine has both potentials. When we are commemorating on Pesach night by drinking 4 cups of wine, every cup was instituted with a mitzvah. We perform a mitzvah right after or right before we drink each cup of wine. We do kiddush, we say hallel, we eat matzah, we eat the meal, we bench on the meal, and at the end we end the hallel. The parsha is going to take us on a journey which will include the punishment of the Mitzrim, the Jews gaining freedom, and God's revelation to the Egyptian population and the Jewish population. God is revealing 2 things. 1, that he is running the show, and 2, that there are 2 peoples in Mitzrayim. As much as the Egyptians had tortured the Jews felt themselves Egyptians. Lower class Egyptians, but nonetheless Egyptians. So much so that 4 out of every 5 Jews didn't want to leave Egypt. Think about an American Jew, a German Jew, not too long ago. I still have the German community where my grandfather lived. They sent their children off to fight World War I, and they were so proud of the children that fell during World War I that they inscribed the Torah hand, the yad that you point on the Sefer Torah, inscribed in their memory. They were proud. For German Jews, where we lost children in battle fighting for the German people in World War I. That's where they were holding. The Jews in Egypt felt themselves Egyptian. And one of the great miracles that is taking place in our parsha is the discernment between Egyptian and Jew. That God is saying, there are two peoples here. When Moshe Rabbeinu speaks to the Jewish people of Yetzias Mitzrayim, one of the things he points out to them, he says, this is a miracle that no God can claim that they have done. You have a people living together, and suddenly he said, a prophet walks in and says, there are two people here. 2 million of this 5 or 6 million population is Jews, and the rest, they're not Jews. And these 2 million, they're coming out with me. We see that much of the Jews lived in what was some kind of ghetto called Goshen, but we also see that the Jews were living among the Mitzri. Part of the Mitzri decree to kill the Jewish boys was that they would have a Jew living between two Mitzrim, meaning a Jewish home had to be situated between two Mitzri homes. And then the Mitzrim would keep an eye on the Jew. They would know when his wife was having her period, when they were together, when they weren't together, and then they would know when to expect the child and when to throw that child into the Nile. So the Jews weren't only living in their quartered section of Goshen. They were living among the Egyptians. And when the time comes for the Jews to leave, up in heaven there's a ruckus. The angels are going to say, what's the difference? Even the angels can't discern between an Egyptian and a Jew. We've become so secularized during this period. So part of what's happening here is the recognition that God is running the show. And part of what's happening here is the recognition that there are two people living in Egypt. There is a sovereign Jewish people, Israeli people, if we want to be more correct. And so these 10 plagues have to happen. They're part of proving that God is running the world, and they're part of showing the Jewish people that they're different. According to one midrash, yeah, they did keep certain things different. It's interesting that there are a lot of Jews that maintain Jewish names and still don't identify as Jews. They don't. It's a nice thing. Even today we see it. You go to in New York, people are proud. I'm a Jew. Yeah. What do? I eat bagels and lox. That's a lot of people. That's the extent of their being Jewish. Yeah.
The Jewish name, how much credit do you give? I mean, those three things that they kept, the language, the clothing, the name, are typical, or very, I find it superficial, or, you know, things, tradition. How far are they credit to the Jewish people that then, what the Jewish name is? I mean, it's about the people, Jewish, not necessarily have Jewish names.
This deserves a class in unto itself to understand what was their obligation at the time. Meaning, the Torah was not yet given. So keeping the Torah was not obligatory at the time. So what was? Bris Milah? What was obligatory? What did they have to do? What did they have to keep? And it seems, according to some Midrashim, that the merits with which we left Egypt was the fact that we did keep those three, our language, our names, our clothing. We did keep difference with those. At any rate, God tells Moshe, I will take the Jews out, and this will go in stages. And the plagues are part of the stages that have to transpire in order for the Jews to leave Egypt. God tells Moshe, I've heard the crying of the Jewish people. There was once a guy who left Judaism, and he didn't have a father, and he married a non-Jewish woman, and he went to live his own life. And day after day, his mother would sit over her Tehillim and weep and say Tehillim. She was a poor woman, she didn't own much, but she'd sit weeping over the Tehillim, and always hoping maybe one day he's going to come back. maybe one day he's going to come back. And throughout her life, she'd spend her days like this. Every few minutes, she'd spend over her tefillin weeping. And her tefillin, the pages already were covered with tears. And then she passed away, and her son was still going his route. But when his mother passed away, so he had to come take care of her things. So he came back to the house, and he saw that tefillin with the pages uneven, and he opened it up. And he saw page after page filled with drops of tears. And when he saw that, that's when he did an about face. So her whole life she was crying. Her whole life she was praying. And she never saw her prayers answered. We have to know in life that God listens. We don't know when we'll see the outcome, but God does listen. The message God is telling us here is that I've listened to the cry of the Jewish people. I've seen how the Egyptians are afflicting them. And now is the time when things have to change. Go tell the Jewish people, I will take them out from under the suffering of the Egyptian people. And the four terms of redemption are really four stages of redemption. Firstly, God says, I'll take them out from under the suffering. That's on Rosh Hashanah. This didn't happen right away. We have a tradition that 6 months into the plagues, the Jews stopped being in servitude. On Rosh Hashanah, the Gemara says, "B'Rosh Hashanah Paskavodah." We stopped working the Egyptians. We had our last 6 months in Egypt, we were free men. V'itzalti yitchem avodatam, God says, I'll save you from their work. That's to be completely free, not to have to pay taxes at all. That's when we became free men from the Egyptians. V'galti yitchem bizua nituyah v'shvatim gdolim, that's Kriyas Yamsuch. When were we fully redeemed? That's when God took us out of Egypt and sunk the Egyptians, because so long as a slave is running away from his master and the master is still around, so he's always looking over his shoulder, maybe one day he's going to catch up with me. The time that we became fully free men, this third stage of redemption, Geula, is when we saw the Egyptian bodies. The Jews came out of the great miracle of the splitting sea and they said, oh, just like we got out on this side, the Egyptians got out on the other side. They weren't calm, and God said, okay, I'll do them an extra favor. And God had the sea split out their bodies on their side, so they saw that all the Egyptians were dead, and then they were able to feel like free men. V'lakachti etchem mil'am, I'll take you to be my nation. That's the fourth term of redemption. That's where God's saying, I'll take you and teach you the Torah. I'll teach you the way that I want you to live life, and I will be your God. You will accept me as your God, and from then on, v'idatem k'ani Hashem lokechem. You'll know that I'm the one running the show. I'm the one who performs miracles and took you out of the servitude of Mitzrayim, even though according to the constellations it's not time to leave. Let's remember, we're talking about Egypt. Everyone's looking at the stars. Someone in the class on astrology tonight, well, we're studying about people who are all steeped in astrology. So everyone here agreed, Jews and Egyptians alike, according to the stars, the Jews aren't supposed to leave Egypt. The stars say we're supposed to remain, and if we leave, we will be destroyed. That's what Paro will warn Moshe in next week's fire show. He'll tell him, I'm warning you, if you leave, according to the stars, you're all going to be wiped out. So everyone agrees. By looking at the stars, Jews and Egyptians agree, we're not supposed to leave now. It's a bad time. And nonetheless, God sends Moshe onto the scene and says, go. You're going to leave. Ask Paro to let you go. Yeah?
The stars is part of Mother Nature. It's natural law. Having a ruler, faith, and belief in a gem, it's way beyond
Mother Nature. It goes all the way up to the sword of the town. Okay. Huh? Nothing. Just the point that believing in a gem is greater than Mother Nature. It goes beyond Mother Nature. God tells the Jewish people, I will bring you to the land that I promised your forefathers. The problem is that we were not brought to the land. So, if we look at the pasuk itself, God tells, I will give it to you, morasha, as something to give over as an inheritance. God already alludes that we will not receive it, that generation will not get it as a yerusha, they will not get it as an inheritance, but rather as a morasha, as something to give over as an inheritance to their children. And in truth, that's what happens. When we evaluate how much each family is supposed to get of the land of Israel, we evaluate by the numbers they had when they left Egypt. The people who left Egypt were entitled to a portion in the land, and they gave that portion over to their offspring, and that's one understanding.
I was thinking, how how best is the explanation that it's simple again that the made the choice, but that it wasn't supposed to happen, this was supposed to happen.
Okay, we know even on the Bchira, God often alludes to what will happen. In last week's parasha, God tells Moshe, now you will see the redemption of the Jewish people, and God alludes to the fact that Moshe will not ultimately see the final redemption entering the land of Israel. God alludes to something which Moshe doesn't yet deserve. God is showing him that he is already showing the signs of weakness that will bring him to his ultimate error. He has the choice, but God knows what he will choose. And God also knows that he is revealing right now what weaknesses will ultimately lead him to that error. We have weaknesses. What? Okay, so if you don't like this shot, so we could go with a different route. There's another shot. God tells the Jewish people, I will take you to be my nation. I will be your God. You will know that I am the God who took you out of Egypt. And then I will bring you to the land of Israel. When the Jews sinned with the Meraglim, they showed that they were not recognizing that God is their God who is running the show. And they did not keep their end of the deal. So then the next part of the deal doesn't have to follow through. God says, you will keep your end of the deal. You'll know that I'm the one running the show who took you out of Egypt. What did the good Jews say? No, we're going back. God can't handle these nations in Israel. He's not really running the show completely. Okay, we didn't keep our end of the deal. So then the deal doesn't have to continue with I will bring you to the land of Israel. Moshe tells the Jewish people, and they cannot listen because they are overworked. Mikotzavach. The pasuk is stressing something amazing. The pasuk is stressing that it's not that they didn't believe. If they would have had strength, in spite of the fact that they were working hard, they were willing to believe. They couldn't listen because they were just working so hard. If you think about what that means, that means that they were on a higher level than Moshe, if we understand things simply. When the work got worse, who was working hard? The Jews, not Moshe. And yet when Moshe saw them working hard, so he turned to God and he said, well, what's going to be, God? How are they going to be saved? The Jews didn't say that. The Jews are working so hard, and yet when Moshe comes and tells them, God sent me, you're going to be taken out, you're coming to the land of Israel. The Jews just don't have sense to listen. But it's not that they don't believe. And that's what God told Moshe in last week's parasha. Moshe said, the Jews won't believe me when I come to them. And God told him, Hey ma'aminim ne ma'aminim, they're believers, the sons of believers. V'atam, but you and Zuchal Amin, you won't have the right faith. But they believe, and that's what we see here. The Jews were ready to believe.
And just so
he
said that
it's
really after the
wedding. Okay, that's true. On certain levels, we see that the Jews evolved in their levels of belief. This whole process is a process of evolvement, but on a certain level they did believe. Why did they believe? So Moshe came to them and proved to them logically that God is the one running the world, and then gave them all the signs, but they didn't believe because of the signs. They believed because Moshe proved it to them logically. Moshe was able to tell them, now I will trace all of world history back to creation, and I'll tell you which nation comes from which person, all the way back to Noah, to the time of the Mabel. Moshe was able to tell them a lot of logical, historical proofs, logical proofs. He told them a lot in last week's parasha. So they maintain their faith. God tells Moshe, go talk to Pharaoh.
What I heard was that after the creating of food, then that's what they believe.
Right? That's another level of belief. With each level, we're going to have to explore what is that. Because it says also in Matthew's Pasha, Vayamena, the nation believed. So how come the Torah keeps telling us they believe, if they didn't advance? So each time we're going to have to explore where did they advance in their belief, if they believed before.
Yeah.
We brought here a beautiful Dvar Torah. You're welcome to read, which also discusses that point. That's going to be posted on the listener's door. I recommend it to everyone. It's about our parasha, and it's about humor in our parasha, God's use of humor.
Two
That's a really, really nice letter. So God tells Moshe, go tell Paro he has to send the Jews out of Egypt. And Moshe says, the Jews aren't listening, how's Paro going to listen? I can't speak clearly. Notice that when things fail, Moshe automatically attributes it to his own weakness. This is a common human flaw. When things don't work out, we think it's because of something we have. If a guy has a new pimple on his nose and he goes to for a job interview and he fails, he comes home thinking it's because of that pimple. A guy thinks he has a lisp and tries to get a job, and then they flunk him on the job. Very often he's going to attribute it to the lisp. Whatever weaknesses we have, sometimes I have a younger brother with CP. So when I started dating, my first fear was that many girls are going to be scared to date me because they're going to say, well, he has a younger brother with CP. So whenever I got to know, the first thing I thought was, oh, it's because of that. So every person has things that they think CP is cerebral palsy. Every person has things that they feel are either hindering them or are weaknesses that they have, and when things go bad, so they think that's why. It's not necessarily why. It's not at all necessarily why. Moshe Rabbeinu, he doesn't know why the Jews aren't listening to him. He thinks the Jews didn't listen to me. I don't speak clearly. How's Paro going to listen to me? And God knows it's not because he didn't speak clearly. They didn't listen to you because they've been overworked. God tells Moshe and Aaron to go take the Jews out of Egypt. And this is an introduction to the whole chapter. And now the Torah gives us some history as to where Moshe comes from. Now, Moshe comes from a very interesting relationship. Levi had a daughter named Yocheved. Levi had a son named Kehas. Kehas had a son named Amram. So Levi's grandson Amram marries Levi's daughter, which is his aunt, marries Yocheved. Now in Judaism you're not allowed to marry an aunt. So sages say Levi had two wives. From one wife he had Yocheved, from the other wife he had Kehas. So now Kehas and Yocheved are half brother and sister, and Kehas's son is a half a nephew to Yocheved, right? Because he comes from a different wife of Levi's, which still doesn't solve the problem because a Jew is not allowed to marry his aunt. But a non-Jew goes by the father. A non-Jew relations go by the father and the mother, and if they don't share a father and a mother, then they're not considered whole relatives. So a brother and a sister, for example, if they don't share a father and a mother, it's unclear that they would be forbidden for a non-Jew. But so therefore Amram can marry his aunt because his aunt is not his aunt through the mother, it's only an aunt through the father. They don't share a father and a mother. You guys with me? No. Okay. Levi had two wives. From one wife he had a daughter, from another wife he had a son. From that son he had a grandson named Amram. Now, Amram is only half related to his aunt because he comes from a different mother. They share a father, they share a grandfather, meaning her father is his grandfather, but they don't share a mother. Her mother is not his grandmother because he comes from the other wife. And therefore, Amram was allowed to marry his aunt.
But
they're not Jewish. The Torah hasn't yet been given. Until the Torah is given, no one's Jewish.
When we say that they live there, they
need
to
use
them as well.
100% right. We are selective, right? How we decide when to select what goes by what either the Torah tells us or our sages tell us. So we have to work it out from there. Meaning we have a tradition they kept the Torah, and then we see that Yaakov married two sisters. So how do we work that out? So there are different answers how we work that out. We discussed that there, and the same thing is true with all the other questions. One wife? I don't think so. You cannot marry two sisters. That it says. So Levi has a daughter named Yocheved. He has a grandson named Amram, and Amram marries his aunt, and they have their eldest daughter Miriam, and then their son Aaron, and then their little boy Moshe. Now Miriam's going to lead the women, she's a great prophetess, and Aaron is going to help Moshe in leading the men and in taking the Jews out of Egypt. We have your three prophets already mentioned. We have the sons of Korah, which are another three prophets, so we have six prophets mentioned, and Pinchas is another prophet, so we have seven prophets here. We have a total of seven prophets. Aaron goes to a different tribe to take his wife. He goes to the tribe of Yehuda, which are the leaders, and he takes the sister of the leader of the tribe of Yehuda, meaning the leader of the tribe of Yehuda is Nachshon, he's the prince, he's the Nasi, and his Aaron marries his sister, which shows us that the house of Kehuna, really, the Aaron, which is going to be the house of priesthood, has married the house of kingship, the house of princehood from Yehuda. We have joined forces here. And now the Torah, and that's why the Torah stresses who she was, that she was Nachshon's sister, that Aaron married a very special woman. Yeah?
Since
she
finds Moshe and Aaron by
it's telling us these are the same Aaron and Moshe, yeah.
And what
so our sages say the Torah is coming to name Aaron before Moshe to tell us sometimes we mention Moshe before Aaron, sometimes we mention Aaron before Moshe, and the idea is that they're equal. Moshe and Aaron are equal. That's what the Medrash says. And there's also the who, like singular, they are equal. So, what?
Yeah, in this person,
that methodology we spend time on. The Torah begins describing the lineage. Elah Hashevet Avotam. These are the heads of the households of the Jewish people. This is unusual in Egypt. You have a head of a household. A man sleeps with many women. A woman sleeps with many men. You never know who their children are from. The Torah is telling us the uniqueness of the Jewish people. They knew who the father was. They knew who the mother was. They knew who the grandfather was. There's lineage. People don't go around with other women. They are faithful to their wives. They are faithful to their homes. And even in Egypt, you have direct lineage, direct descendants. Moshe can trace who he comes from. Aaron can trace who he comes from. Something to be proud of. And that's what the Torah is telling us over here also. Something to remember. When people are young, so very often they have tendency to want to go around, especially if they're not religious. Torah is telling us, no, that's not the way we behave, even in the worst of times. The Jewish people didn't behave this way, and the Jewish people were able to trace their lineage. The Torah is stressing now the difference between the Jews and the Egyptians. These are the heads of the household of the Jewish people. And the Torah begins the enumeration. God tells Moshe, I am Hashem, I'm running the world. And go speak to Pharaoh what I will tell you. Moshe comes with a complaint, I can't see clearly, and God tells him, I want you to know, I have placed you in charge of Pharaoh. Pharaoh tells the world, Li Yovid Ani Asitini, I created the Nile, I am master of the world. I don't even have to go to the bathroom. I am supernatural. I might be a midget, the size of your arm, but I am supernatural. I am Pharaoh. I run the world. And God says to Moshe, well, if he's a god, you're a greater god. He's no god, and you're powerful, you're above him. You go talk to Pharaoh, and I'm giving you the power, you are in charge of him. You, so to speak, are the god over him. Not that Moshe is a god, but Moshe is given the power, so to speak, to take control of the situation. He's come to talk to the man who brought him up. The man was his stepfather for much of his life. And now God tells him, Ve'ein netaticha Elokim leFaroh. Look, I have appointed you in charge of Pharaoh. You're in charge of taking control of the show now. And Aaron is going to be your speaker. Go talk what I tell you. We see that God keeps telling Moshe, you're going to have to do what I say. Do not be scared. Moshe began his job as a prophet with the snake. And when he saw the snake, he ran. The snake represents Pharaoh. God tells him, go grab that snake. Go hold on to the snake's tail. You're going to control that snake. And that's what Moshe is going to do now. He's going to control that snake. Do not be scared. When God sends the prophets to a difficult task, God tells him, do not be scared. Stand up there. I'm with you. I'm telling you to do it. So now God tells Moshe, go. Go talk to Pharaoh what I tell you. And Aaron will be with you. Moshe and Aaron go. If you recall the last time they went, all the elders got scared and didn't accompany them. They started the journey, and one by one they fell by the wayside until Moshe and Aaron come up to the palace gates and they're all alone. Now they begin their journey alone. God forewarns Moshe, I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and you will do all my signs, and Pharaoh will not listen to you. And I will take out my armies. What are my armies? I have 12 armies here on earth, the 12 tribes. Astrologically, we have 12 constellations. They are representative of the 12 tribes. We have 12 months. Every tribe has a month that it corresponds to. We have 12 mazalot, 12 constellations in the zodiac. Each one corresponds to a different tribe. Each tribe has a different strength. Each tribe has different representation in the heavens. The heavenly stars are called God's armies. They are the armies of the moon. They are the armies of God. We say that in Iris. We say that in Tehillim. And God is saying, when I sent the Jews down to Egypt, I went with them. I joined the Jews in their sorrow. Imo anochi v'tzarah. And so too, when it's time to take them out, I will come out of Egypt with them. And when I go down to Egypt, I take my armies down to Egypt. So now it's time to take out the armies from Egypt. Be it the physical, human, Jewish armies that are in Egypt, be it the spiritual, godly armies that I send down with them to Egypt. When I take them out of Egypt, it will be with great judgment. God is going to judge. God is going to show He judges the world. One of the reasons it is difficult to recognize that God runs the world is because we see that God does not seem to be judging the world. We see people doing bad things, and they don't seem to be paying the price for it. That's why when people see a man like Saddam Hussein fall on the gallows, they say, Baruch Hashem. They say, wow, here God is revealing that He is judging the world. Now, we have to ask ourselves a question, a philosophical question. What is going to be gained by these judgments? The Jewish babies that have been killed are not going to be returned. The Jews that have suffered, that suffering will not be wiped away. What is the purpose of the punishments that will be wrought upon the Egyptian people now? And that is a question we have to ask ourselves in general. When we think about the concept of punishment, when we think about the concept of retribution, what is the purpose? As a human, they say, well, you hit me, I'll hit you back. That's a natural urge. But we're talking about God. What is the purpose of what God will do in our parsha? And if you want some of the answer, you could think back to how we introduced our parsha. What the four cups represent, the four cups of salvation of the Jewish people. They represent the good of the tzaddik, the bad of the rasha, and why does it have to be bad for the rasha? That's something we're going to leave open for now. Maybe as we go through the parsha, we'll start getting a picture of an answer. The Egyptians will know that I am God. Why is it important for the Egyptians to know that God is running the world? We know that there seems to be a drive in the world. The world is moving towards recognition that God is running the world. It's one of the things the prophets keep telling us. We'll reach a point where all the nations will look up to the Jewish people and say, oh, you're right, God is running the world. It seems to be something to aspire to. What?
When the Mashiach comes out, happens.
Who knows? I will take the Jews out from within their midst, as we discussed. They're coming to stand before Pharaoh. God tells Moshe and Aaron, when Pharaoh asks you for a sign, tell Aaron to throw the staff before Pharaoh. It will turn into a tannin. What is a tannin? A tannin is a snake. According to some understandings, it's a crocodile, but simple understanding, it's a snake. Why does the staff have to turn into a snake? Because the first one to sin in this world was the snake, the serpent. How did the snake sin? With the way he spoke. How has Pharaoh sinned right now? Pharaoh has spoken. Pharaoh has said, who is God that I should listen to him? What was the snake's sin when it sinned? The snake said, God is going to be jealous. God is scared that you too will be able to be like him and take his strength. If you eat from this fruit, he belittled God. He said, you can overcome God. What is Pharaoh doing in this fight with Moshe and Aaron? He is constantly trying to belittle God. He is bringing in his magicians and saying, my magicians can do the same. My wife can do the same. My kids can do the same. The first sign he gets, the staff turns into a snake. And a snake is a creature that doesn't stay in one place. It slithers. It coils, it uncoils. So too, Pharaoh is going to say, yeah, I'm going to let them go. And then he's going to turn back and say no. And then he's going to turn back and say yes. And then go back and say no. He's like a snake. Back and forth. And Pharaoh is really compared to a snake in the prophecies, where God says he is that great snake that lies in denial and says, I created the Nile, I made myself, I am self-made. You, Aaron, you, Moshe, have control over that staff. You grab it and hold on to it. Our sages say, Moshe took the staff and waved it in front of Paro's face and said, with this I will hit you. With this you will be punished. And in truth, with that he was punished. That staff is what brought the plagues upon the people of Egypt. Think about it. You have the greatest empire. You have the greatest man in the greatest empire. And he has this kid who's now 80 years old, who he brought up on his lap, who used to grab the crown off his head. And this kid is standing before him. He's no longer a kid. He's 80 years old. And he's saying, with this I will hit you. Who is he? He's head of the slaves. He's the head of the union. No one likes him. But they're going to learn to respect him. And one of the miracles that happen in our parashios is the fact that Paro doesn't have him beheaded. You'd think, after everything Moshe says, Moshe's walking in before Paro, Paro would just tell him, man, take off his head. What does Paro have to listen to this for? We will see that at the root of it all, Paro and his men know from the beginning, and they will only allow themselves to admit it at the end, but they know that God is really the one running the show. And this gives us a little bit of insight into the way all of us work and why God has a claim from non-Jews. Because everyone deep down inside knows what's right. Even the person who says, I don't know and I don't believe, deep down inside he knows what's right. There's a beautiful song about the atheist convention in LA. I don't remember who put it out. About three atheists sitting on a plane on a journey to the atheist convention in LA. And they look at the religious guy sitting next to them, and he takes out a sandwich and makes a blessing. And they ask one another, can he be so naive to still believe that someone up there is watching over him? And suddenly there's a flash of lightning, and the plane loses control and starts heading down. And the three atheists, one's name was Muhammad, he yells out, save me, Allah. And the other one's name was Christopher, he yells out to Jesus. And the third one, his name was Jonathan, he says, Shema Yisrael. And second before crashing, the plane straightens out, and the Jew looks over to the three and he says, will you three still be going, with your true colors showing, will you three still be going to the atheist convention in LA? And the song continues. If I remember, I'll try to bring you guys a copy for next Thursday. No, I think we have it at home.
Where in LA?
I don't know where in LA. But the song represents something which is true. Deep down inside, everyone has a voice talking. The question is, do we want to listen to it? So Paro and the people, they really know that Hashem is running the show. As we will see, they will be talking that way. Paro even refers to Hashem. And even his magician said, this is the finger of God, when they recognize what's going on. So they throw the staff before him, and Paro says, this is a city filled with hay. You're walking in to sell hay. This is a city filled with magicians. You're coming in with magic. So Paro's wife automatically throws down her stick and makes it into a snake. Paro calls the kids, and they make it into snakes. And then he calls his warlocks, and they turn their staffs into snakes. There is a great discussion here among the sages. How did this work? Were these magicians really able to change materials? And some say they were not, that everything they did was achizat inayin, something like the magic I do. Looks one way, but really it's not that way. Okay, you can make something look that way, but it isn't. And others say that no, they really did have the ability to change materials. But what they couldn't do is the next thing that happens, and that is when Aaron's staff as a stick swallowed up their sticks, so that they could not do. That was a sign that God is over all of it. He wasn't playing their games. So Pharaoh's heart is hardened and he's not listening. God tells Moshe, I see his heart is hardened. Go in the morning, when he's going out to the Nile, way early in the morning, to go to the bathroom, because he tells everyone he never goes. Then go catch him. Now, Moshe had a special staff. Moshe's staff was the one we discussed last week that he took out of Yisro's garden. a special staff that Yisro had stolen from Paro, that Paro had gotten from way back when, that has a whole long history, and that staff has engraved on it the Tzach Hadash Be'achaz, the an acronym for the Makos, and also has God's hidden name written on it. And that staff is not the one they're taking to Paro's bathroom. That's why God stresses, take the staff, take Aaron's staff that turned into a snake, that's the staff you take with you, and tell him that God sent you, send my nation and they will serve me. You haven't listened till here. Now God says, you will know that I'm the one running the show. With this staff I will turn the water into blood. Now the water is going to turn to blood in every way. It's going to look like blood, it's going to taste like blood, and that's why the fish die, and it's going to smell like blood, and that's why all of Egypt starts stinking. So Moshe forewarns Paro, and then we see a change. Moshe does not lift the staff over the Nile, but rather Aaron lifts the staff over the Nile, because Moshe was saved by the Nile. When he was a baby, his mother placed him in a casket in the Nile, and so Moshe shows hakarat hatov, recognition for the good that the Nile did to him. Bava deshatit mineh, if you drink from a well, lotishile beikala, don't throw in a clod of earth. Some, even an inanimate object that gives us benefit, we treat with respect. That's why people sometimes they kick their school bag or they throw down their coat. You just use that coat, treat it with respect. It's the coat that just warmed you all day. Where in Judaism we are trained not only to treat our fellow man with respect, but even to treat inanimate objects with respect. When King David cuts off the corner of King Saul's cloak in order to later on be able to prove to his father-in-law King Saul, I could have killed you, look at the corner of your cloak, it's in my hands, you were sitting there in the cave, I snuck up behind you, I could have killed you, by the same token I took off the corner of your cloak. Seems like a good purpose, and yet he has pangs of guilt. How could I cut the corner of his coat? And when King David becomes an old man, he tries getting warm and he cannot. The clothes will not warm him. Because when he was younger, there was that one time when he didn't treat clothing with the proper respect. He took advantage of them, he cut off a corner of a coat in order to prove something, in order to prove a point, which ultimately didn't work. It's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. Maybe we'll say that those are conflicting addressing, I don't know. You're saying, according to the understanding that this was a fulfillment of Shmuel's prophecy, I don't know. We could answer it, but I don't know. I'd like to see someone else answer it. I mean, the question is strong. Any answer that I give would have to be to modify something that our sages say, which I'm not the shoulders to do. Someone probably asked the questions. We have to see. At any rate, back to our story. So Moshe is not the one to turn the Nile into blood, but rather he leaves it to his brother Aaron. All the water turns to blood. So how do the Egyptians get water? So first you have to know the pshat that your children are going to come home with from God. And that is one medrash that says that God made it so that if an Egyptian would hold a cup of water, it would turn to blood. He'd give it to a Jew, it would turn to water. Then you say, give me that back. Take it back, turns to blood. And he'd say, now you wait, you stand right here. Hold this cup of water. The Jew holds the cup of water, the Egyptian brings a straw. They had reeds back then. Starts sipping from the cup, the water turns to blood in his mouth. He says, ugh, no, let's sip together. The Jew starts sipping from his straw, the Egyptian from his straw. The Egyptian comes out blood, the Jew comes out water. So the Egyptian has no way out. He says, okay, I'll buy the water from you. And if the Egyptian would pay the Jew for water, first time they sold bottled water, if the Egyptian would pay the Jew for water, so then it would remain water. That's the medrash that's taught to all the children. There is such a medrash. Including all the parts that I said, the medrash enumerates everything from the straws down. But that's one medrash. Now, our other understanding is how this works. The Torah testifies that the Nile turned to blood, and there was blood throughout Egypt on the stones, on the trees. So all water that was visible turned to blood. But what about the water that was underground? So here, according to this medrash, even that turned to blood. But there are those that are of the opinion that did not turn to blood. And so that is where the Egyptian magicians got their water from, to tell Paro here, we could turn to blood also, and they turned it into blood. There is an opinion that says that the Egyptian magicians were cheaters. They said, we'll turn the water to blood. So Moshe, the makkah was twofold. First they turned the Nile to blood, and then they extended the staff over the rest of Egypt and turned the rest of the water to blood. So when they turned the Nile to blood, the Egyptians said, they knew where Moshe was headed. Moshe had told them that he's going to turn the rest of the water to blood. So they told Paro, and now we're going to say our incantation, and all the water outside the Nile that's left will turn to blood. And they knew that a second later that's what Moshe would do. So when Moshe did it, Moshe turned it into blood, but they said, oh, we did that. That wasn't Moshe. That was our incantation. That's another shot. At any rate, the fish all die, and the Egyptians can't drink water from the Nile. Paro, who claimed that he was the god over the Nile, now is having a hard time answering questions. There's a god above Paro. And so the story begins. 7 days they have a plague, and now they have three weeks break. 1 week plague, 3 weeks break. That's the way the plagues work. Each plague took a month. 1 week the plague, 3 weeks the break, during which Moshe was forewarning of the next plague. Now again, Paro is told, send my nation. If you refuse, I'll send Sfardim, which literally means frogs. Now one of the interesting things that the chief rabbi of Egypt points out in Netzvar Torah is that the frog in Egypt represented the god of fertility. And when the Egyptians were being punished with frogs, they were being punished for taking the midwives who were responsible for fertility and telling them, you murder the Jewish babies. So now God was, so to speak, paying them back on with their language. They believed that the frogs represented the goddess of fertility, who was in charge of labor, of giving birth properly. So they were being punished with the frogs. And here there are two midrashim. There's one midrash that says that a huge frog came out of the Nile, and the Egyptians tried to kill it, and every time they'd hit it, so a bunch of little frogs came jumping out. And there's another midrash that says that tons of frogs came hopping out of the Nile into Egypt. Now the frogs were jumping into their mouths, into their bedrooms, into their beds. The pasuk says this. And all over Egypt you have noise. You have noise and you have frogs jumping all over. I had once, we had a carcass of a dead cat in our miklat, and no one took care of it. And after a few months, it got fleas. And I went down to the miklat to take out my sukkah on Matzah Yom Kippur. Fleas, I think. No fleas. Little black things that jump. And I walk into the house, and I'm covered with little black things. And they jumped off me into the house. And now we have a house filled with fleas. Now, fleas are these little things that can jump about 60 times their size. I mean, they could jump like really high. They're working now on taking that gene and planting in humans, that humans can jump high. These fleas, they're not frogs. They weren't climbing. You can't feel when they're climbing all over you. You just feel as they're biting you. It's like mosquitoes all over the house. We couldn't sleep at night. It was terrible. One night, we got an exterminator. No, we're naturalists. We tried to figure a natural way of fighting them, but it took one night. We were in exile, and we ran out of the house. We spent the night out of the house. Imagine frogs. Climbing, creeping, slimy, in your bed, on your head, everywhere you go. Sages say that the frogs jumped into their stomachs and jumped all around their stomachs. And Paro had embarrassment. He had to go to UN meetings, and he had frogs coming with him. And the world was hearing about the Egyptian problems, the plagues that were plaguing the Egyptians. So the frogs would jump into the ovens, and the Egyptian would try to cook something, and a frog would jump in. And from there we derive a halacha. When Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were being told by the king of Babylon, either bow to my idol or I will throw you into a burning furnace, they said, well, if the frogs gave up their lives, as the Torah testifies, they jumped into the oven because God said so, well, God told us not to bow to this idol, so we're no worse than the frogs, so you'll throw us into the furnace. So we learn out from the frogs that for God's sake, oh yeah, they happen to come out okay, yeah. That doesn't always work, but they did. I wouldn't try that at all. They themselves said, we have no guarantee this is going to work. God may save us and he may not. In their case, God chose to save them. I think maybe I don't know. Good question. I don't know. So even the king's bedroom has frogs, and everyone's suffering. And Pharaoh calls Moshe and Aaron and says, "Pray to God, he should remove the frogs from me and my nation, and I'll send them." You see, Pharaoh gave in. And Moshe says, "Okay, show off. Tell me when you want it." And Pharaoh figures, well, if he's asking me now, it must be that according to the constellations, the plague's supposed to end now. So Pharaoh says, tomorrow. So Moshe says, fine, we'll do what you want. And so the plague ended the next day. Pharaoh thought, must be that this is all according to the stars, this is what's supposed to happen. And Moshe knows, according to the stars, that it's supposed to end this second. So he's asking me, when do I want? And of course I'll say now. So Pharaoh says, I'll outsmart him, I'll say tomorrow. And Pharaoh's going to pay for that tomorrow for the rest of the plague. Because from now on, every time Pharaoh is going to call Moshe to remove a plague, Moshe will say, fine, tomorrow. So I'll go pray, and tomorrow the plague will be gone. Because on every other time, Pharaoh calls him, so Moshe can't know when he'll call him. So the frogs die, and Egypt is stinking from frogs, and they have to have the garbage collectors make piles of frogs all over, and the land smells. Of course, in the Jewish land, they don't have such a problem. Yeah?
Why did
Vayitzak?
Yes.
So, Vayitzak can either mean that he yelled, or Vayitzak can mean that he said a short prayer. Tzaka could mean either one. You could look by Miriam. In fact, when Miriam has Tzaraas, so over there it also says that he was tzoek, if I'm not mistaken, and Rashi says that a short prayer is called a tzaka. So either it was a short prayer or there were a lot of frogs there, and when a person prays he's supposed to hear his own voice. So we always say do the minimum, whisper the minimum that you need in order to hear yourself. Here, in order to hear himself, he had to speak pretty loudly. Pharaoh sees things are better, so he has a heavy heart. That's the way we all are. Sages say when a person gets ill, he's supposed to consider it as though there's a sign from him, and he's supposed to think for himself what he has to improve. Usually, even if a person thinks that, by the time he gets better, he's forgotten his conclusions. That's the way it is Yom Kippur also. The average person thinks before Rosh Hashanah, what am I going to do better? For Yom Kippur, he has 100 different things. After Yom Kippur, he goes out and buys pizza, and he leaves all the hopes back with Yom Kippur. But here at Machon Meir we're different. The mere fact that you walk into Machon Meir shows you're different. It means you're willing to take an aspiration and fix it. At least everyone sitting on the other side of this table is different. The fact that I'm here doesn't prove anything. But anyone else that's here, that's it's impressive. It shows that people stick to a goal. Pharaoh sees that things are better. He has a heavy heart. God tells them, no warning now. Now the Makkah of Kinim. Now you guys have to see something cool. We'll go to the next. Every third plague, there's no warning. Kinim, there's no warning. It's just going to come. Let's first do the plague, just to get them in order. We have Shishtach, Adash, Shishtach.
Thank you.
Pinyin, Hoshen, and Hoshen. Hoshen. And Pinyin. Spells Hoshen, Hoshen, and Pinyin. This is the type. These three ways, you spell Hoshen, Hoshen, Pinyin. Spells going downwards, Hoshen, Hoshen, and Pinyin. So those three, it's not my thought, the Bechor Shor points it out, if I'm not mistaken. Hoshech, Chin, and Kinim, each one is, these are the third plagues. They spell going down if you put them in that order. Hoshech, Chin, and Kinim. So then the letters going downwards, the first letter of each word, and then the second letter, and the third letter also spell Hoshech, Chin, and Kinim. So he says something which I don't know exactly how to understand. He says that all three came at once. So I don't know if he means that three times they had all three at once, or just one time. I don't know what he means by that. But he says that they came without warning and they came at once. If you want to see a beautiful thought on the parasha of Hirsch, explains the evolvement of the makos, the evolvement of the plagues, what's the logical sequence in sets of three, in series of three, what is the build up, and one of the things he deals with is also two warnings and one not. So now we have Kinim. There's lice and the Egyptian magicians, they can't deal with that because they can't deal with anything that's smaller than an adasha. An adasha is some kind of lentil. They're really what? Listen to me.
Is it a minus or is it
one opinion says that it was just sleight of hand. One opinion says that they were able to talk to demons and get them to do things for them. So the earth turned into Kinim. One understanding why the Egyptian magicians couldn't do anything is because in order for a magician to do something, they have to be standing on the ground. There's the famous story of the 80 women who were doing black magic, and one of the sages took his 80 students and he took them through the rain and he had them take their garments in an earthenware vessel upside down. You guys know the story. They came to the cave where they were all hiding out, and then he told them, just as they're at the outskirts of the cave, now put on your dry clothing. So they walk into the cave, and the chief lady said, who are you guys? So he said, we're all magicians like you, we came to marry you. So she said, prove it. So he said, we're all wearing dry clothing. I had my men walk between the drops, it's pouring rain outside, and we're magicians, we walked between the drops. So she said, fine. So each one of his men picked up a girl, and when they lifted them off the ground, so then they weren't able to do their magic, and then they brought them to court to be tried for what they did. According to one version, they ended up marrying them. Different versions as to exactly what happened, but from there we learn from that story that people who perform this kind of black magic can't do it unless they're standing on the ground. The second they lift them off the ground, they couldn't harm them, they couldn't do anything to them. So too over here, the Egyptian magicians, they had no ground to stand on because all the ground turned into lice. So they're standing on lice, they're not standing on the ground, so they can't do their magic anymore. So the Egyptians tell Paro, this is a finger of God, and the simple understanding is that this time they admitted, and another understanding says that they said this was supposed to happen according to the stars. They said Etzba Elokim. They didn't say Etzba Hashem, God's hand. They said Etzba Elokim. Elokim could mean God. Elokim could mean the forces. We know that every force, even a judge, is called Elokim. Anyone that has power in this world. So they said this is a finger of the forces. They said, you know, according to the constellations, this is what should have happened. Moshe didn't do this. So Pharaoh hardens his heart. Notice these magicians keep helping him harden his heart.
God tells Moshe, go early, tell Pharaoh that he should send the nation, and if he doesn't, I'll send the wild animals. Now, the wild animals are coming from the desert, and this time God says, we'll discern between Egyptian and Jew. This is the first time the Torah explicitly says it. That's why there are opinions that say that the first three makos came upon Egyptian like Jew. That's not the medrash your children are going to learn in Gan. Your children are going to learn throughout their elementary school years that Jews did not get the makos, just like we described before, that even the blood, you drink from two straws, the Jew would get water, the Egyptian would get blood. But this is the first time the Torah points out that the Jews will be separated, that the land of Goshen will not be harmed, and that the Jews will not be harmed, meaning even if a Jew enters Egyptian territory, nothing bad will happen to him from these wild animals that are going to devour and kill the Egyptians. Now the Midrash and your children will hear that God sent all kinds of animals. God sent animals with long hands, and animals that could climb, and animals that could stay inside, animals that could break down doors, and elephants, and everything. So you have a stampede of wild animals entering Egypt. The Egyptians enter their homes and lock the doors. So God sends animals with long tentacles with their hands through the chimney, through the windows, to open the doors, and then the animals barge in and kill. This is what your children will hear. This is a medrash, and medrash you should know. We could interpret it that maybe God sent monkeys climbing down the chimney or through whatever it was, whatever holes they had in their homes, to enter and open the doors, and then the wild animals would enter and kill whoever was there. So you have stampedes of wild animals entering Egypt, coming from the desert, and Moshe forewarns them that this is going to happen, and they've seen that whatever Moshe says happens. And God tells them in Goshen, this isn't going to happen, and Jews will not be harmed by it, and that's what happens. Stampedes of wild animals enter Egypt and destroy much of the land. Paro calls, yeah.
How much do we know the animals, the whole people of Egypt, when it is the monarch controlling the decisions?
So we see not that way. We see they had a say. We see they had a hand in harming the Jews, and we see they had a say in what's going on. Wait, we'll see next week's parsha. When they want to protest, they do protest. And next week's parsha, when they had enough and they say we're going to lose, everything's going to be destroyed. When they think they have enough to lose, then they do open their mouths. So we see they could speak. We have a medrash that says that they were the ones that insisted on putting the Jews in servitude, and when Paro refused, they demoted Paro for 3 months. For 3 months, they took Paro off his throne. So it seems like the people do have a say in what's going on. Paro calls Moshe and Aaron and he says, go serve your God in the land. Moshe and Aaron give an excuse. They say, we can't do that here. We're going to serve our God and shech these animals in front of them. They serve these animals. Of course, they'll stone us. We'll have to go 3 days' journey. And Paro promises he'll send them. I want to end with a few points to notice. The death of the animals is going to happen very near the land of Goshen. The next plague is Dever. God is going to send the plague that animals die. The Egyptians didn't shepherd their animals near their home. They served the animals. So when they let the animals graze with shepherds, they send them out near the land of Goshen where the Jews lived. The Jews didn't bow to these animals, it seems, or even though they were serving idols like the Egyptians, I guess they were more comfortable with shepherds. So God is saying there'll be a tremendous miracle here, that right near the land of Goshen, where all the animals are grazing, all the Egyptian animals will die, and whatever disease is hanging in the air that's killing all the Egyptian animals won't affect the Jewish animals, which are right next door. Our sages say that when the plagues hit, so there was an international quarrel going on between Egypt and one of the neighboring countries as to where the boundary lay. And based upon the plague, they proved where the boundary was, because they said, you see, the plague isn't hitting in our territory. And up until this point, the plague is hitting. What? I don't know. I don't remember. So that brought peace to the world. The plague of boils, also the magicians are embarrassed to stand before Moshe, because it shows it affects them too. They're all covered with boils, with shchin, blisters. When Moshe throws the ash into the air, there are three miracles. One, that in one hand Moshe was able to accept what took four hands, meaning he took two hands full, and Aaron took two handfuls, and then they piled all four handfuls into Moshe's hand, and boy, what arm he has. He drew that clot of earth, and the second miracle spread out all over Egypt, and the third miracle is that it actually caused everyone to have boils. What? Would seem that way. Doesn't, I don't remember it saying it explicitly, but it would seem that way. What? Where does it say that? It says he threw it over Egypt. He threw it to the sky.
For the
boil. What?
For the
boil.
Yeah.
First test, that's a good. And here God hardens Pharaoh's heart, and we'll end with a few understandings into that as far as God's hardening his heart. One understanding is that God only hardened his heart with relevance to sending the people out now. Until now he had free choice, and like a kid, he gets out of bed 15 times. So he's telling you can, or take a different example. A kid, he has a little sister that's learning how to walk. Every time she stands up, he knocks her down and she hits her head. So he tells the kid, don't do that again. Next time she tries to stand up, he knocks her down and laughs. Tell him, don't do that again. Does it a second time. Tell him, look, you're going to do it again. I'm going to hit you. So he does it again. At some point, you're going to have to hit the kid. He's not going to... If you told him, I'm going to hit you if you do it. So, comes to that point where the kid knocks his sister down. She hits her head on the stone floor and says, told you not to do it. The kid says, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Dad. I'm really, really sorry. I really feel bad. Really. At some point, part of the punishment is, they say, no, now you can't say you're sorry. That's it. It's over. Now you're going to get whatever punishment it is that you're going to get, you're going to get it. It's a now I'm sorry isn't going to cut it. That's the concept of hardening Pharaoh's heart. That Pharaoh was supposed to get the extension of the punishment. That Pharaoh, until this point, hasn't given in, and his people haven't given in, now it's not enough to say I'm sorry. Now you can't say I'm sorry. That's one understanding. That at some point, it's time for the punishment. The second understanding, and there are more, is that God only hardened Pharaoh's heart with respect to one thing. If Pharaoh would have wanted to believe in God, Pharaoh would have wanted to acknowledge that God is running the show and said, okay, you guys go, I believe God is running the show, he could have done it at any given moment. With respect to a specific point, God hardened his heart. Meaning, naturally, Pharaoh didn't have to believe God was running the show. He just had to see. The country's getting destroyed. There's going to be nothing left. He's losing. At some point, you say, I don't care if God's running the show. Go! I'm losing. I'm getting punished. My people are getting punished. People are dying. Animals are dying. Everything is being lost. Go. So the first five plagues before God hardened his heart, Pharaoh could have said that. Pharaoh could have said, I see I'm losing. I don't care if God's running the show or not. You guys go. After he didn't do that the first five times, God said, from now on, I'm not letting you get away with that. You're going to be punished until you're willing to admit that I run the show. And with respect to that point, God hardened his heart. That a natural leader would have said, I've had enough. I'm losing. I'm suffering. My people are suffering. Go. With respect to that point, God hardened his heart that he wouldn't say that. And what was left was for him to say, I believe. I admit God is running the show. That's where he had to get to. And that he wasn't willing to get to until the 10th plague. That point to say God is running the show, I give in, to that point he wasn't willing to come until he suffered all 10 plagues, and it was only with respect to giving in order to save his hide that God said, with respect to that, I'm going to harden his heart. But had he wanted to really say, you guys go, I give in, God's running the show, that he could have always done. And have Shabbat Shalom. Yizrat Shem, we'll continue next week. We have, if you guys could please clean up.